So, a little story to begin with. Once upon a time, many years ago, in the wonderful country of India, where in fact I was born, that's not part of the story, but it's true, there was a king. They called him the Raja. Six blind men were invited to visit the palace of the Raja and encounter an elephant for the first time. As each man touched the animal with his hands, he announced what he felt and what he deduced, and he came to some conclusions about his discoveries. The first blind man put out his hand and touched the side of the elephant, and he said, "Wow, how smooth. An elephant is like a wall." Second blind man put out his hand and touched the trunk of the elephant. He said, "Wow, how round. An elephant is like a snake." And the third blind man put out his hand and touched the tusk of the elephant and said, "Wow, how sharp. An elephant is like a spear." Fourth blind man put out his hand and touched the leg of the elephant, and he said, "How tall, how thick, an elephant is like a tree." And the fifth blind man reached out his hand and touched the ear of the elephant, and he said, "Wow, how wide and how light, an elephant is like a fan." And the sixth blind man put out his hand and touched the tail of the elephant, and he said, "How thin, yet how strong, an elephant is like a rope." Now, if you're expecting a punchline, there's no joke, all right? An argument ensued, each blind man thinking that his own perception of the elephant was, of course, the correct one. Well, so great was the commotion and the argument that the Raja, who was resting in his bedroom, was woken up. And he came out of his French windows, and he got onto the balcony, and he looked down to these guys down in the courtyard, and he shouted to them. He said, "Listen, the elephant is a big animal. Each one of you has just touched one part of the elephant. You must put all the parts together to find out what the elephant is really like." So, enlightened by the Raja's wisdom, the blind men reached agreement. They said, "Yes, that's true. Each one of us knows just only a part. So to find out the whole truth, we must put all these different parts together." Now, that tale, and perhaps different versions of it which you might have heard, that is often used to illustrate the issue that we are considering tonight in this Face the Book event, the issue of pluralism. Put very simply, pluralism is that opinion. Those who advocate religious pluralism argue that the different religious faiths represent just one part of a larger truth about God. Each religion has only a piece of the truth, but each is ultimately leading us to God, only, of course, by different routes. But no one religion can claim exclusive truth or absolute truth. Pluralism. So, how should we respond to that assertion, to that argument? It sounds very plausible, doesn't it? Sounds very reasonable. Sounds commendable. It urges tolerance, doesn't it, towards all other faiths and all other points of view. And of course, it's often used because of that to disparage the claims of Christians, evangelical Christians, who say that Jesus' claim to be the way, the truth, and the life is too dogmatic. That when he says no one can come to the Father but by him, that's a very bigoted and narrow-minded approach. It's oppressive. How can we be so dogmatic? How can we be so insensitive to other religions? How can we be so arrogant as to make those types of exclusive claims for Jesus Christ and for the Christian faith? And then, on what right do we have to go to other peoples, perhaps to other cultures, to other religions, and try and persuade them of the truth of Christianity? What right do we have to do that? How should we respond to this argument, which is prevailing in our society today? Well, first of all, I think we need to respond with honesty. Honesty. We need to admit that too often we have presented ourselves and our arguments in an arrogant and an aggressive way. We have to confess that the cardinal Christian virtue of humility has not always characterized the church or Christian people. Too often we have exported too much of our own Western culture along with the faith that we seek to bring to people of other cultures and other religions. And so such cultural imperialism in the name of Christ, we have to be honest and say that's regrettable. And it's a fact of missionary history. Myself, as a family, we lived in Namibia for 12, 13 years. Long enough to hear from fellow Christian believers, African brothers and sisters, some amazing, hair-raising accounts of the attitudes and actions of fellow missionaries. White, usually UK, European, American, evangelical missionaries, towards their African colleagues and their fellow Christians. We have to say, yeah, we're guilty sometimes. Historically, we've been guilty. We have to respond with honesty. Secondly, I think we have to respond with realism. Realism about the situation that we're in today. Many of the nations of the modern world, like the UK, we are multicultural societies. Travel, migration of peoples and populations in the 20th century has produced a very different world from the world of just 50, 60, 70 years ago. And hand in hand with multiculturalism has come religious pluralism. Those are the facts. We live in a religiously pluralistic context today in the UK, and there's no sense in denying that. And so on that factual level, pluralism today simply means the observation that in our society there is a plurality of religions. That's the facts. We have to be real about it. Thirdly, I think we should respond with enthusiasm. Too many Christians today, I think, are filled with nostalgia for the days that are no more. They tend to live in the past, in denial of these present realities that face us. And so rather than embracing them positively and seeing the new exciting challenges and the enrichment that a multicultural and a pluralistic situation brings us, they complain about the loss of a way of life, or perhaps they are fearful about the introduction of ways and beliefs that threaten them. Actually, we need to be enthusiastic. God has brought the world to us, to the UK, to Cardiff. We have amazing opportunities now to share, to show God's love to people of other faiths without even having to get on a plane. We don't have to go halfway around the world these days. Let's respond with enthusiasm. And fourthly, I think we should respond with understanding. What do I mean by that? Well, perhaps before we jump to defense, or in, as I've said, to be rather aggressive, we need to understand that in and of itself, pluralism is not a bad thing. We need to understand what the more moderate proponents of pluralism are saying today. Here are just 4 points from a recent article by Diana Eck, who is committed to what's called the Pluralism Project in Harvard University in the States. She writes this. I was quite surprised to read it. She writes, pluralism is the energetic engagement with diversity. The energetic engagement with diversity. You see, diversity is a given. We live in a diverse society. But pluralism is not. Pluralism is an achievement. If you only have diversity, even if you recognize you have diversity, if that's all you have, you will still have the creation of religious and ethnic ghettos with little traffic between them. Secondly, she says, pluralism is not just tolerance, but the active seeking of understanding across lines of difference. See, the problem with just exercising tolerance is that it does nothing to remove the stereotypes, the fears, perhaps, which, if we're honest, we might have. The half-truths about those people, about people of that religion. And these fears and half-truths, they underlie old patterns that foster division and even violence in our society. So tolerance is not enough. We need the active seeking of understanding across lines of difference. And then thirdly, and this is very interesting, she says pluralism is not relativism, but the encounter of commitments. The new paradigm of pluralism does not require us to leave our identities and our commitments behind. And so fourthly, she says, pluralism therefore means dialogue. What does dialogue mean? Well, dialogue means speaking and listening, genuinely listening. Dialogue does not mean that everyone at the table will agree with one another, but pluralism involves at least the commitment to being at the table, with one's own commitment still intact. Now, I say we need to understand what people mean, therefore, by pluralism. I think there's much in that sort of process, if that's what they mean by pluralism, that we as Christians would want to endorse. We need to be in dialogue, while not at all forsaking our own faith commitments. We need to be prepared to speak and to listen, really to listen, so that those unhelpful stereotypes will be broken down, and perhaps we'll be part of God's way of creating a new atmosphere of trust and neighborliness in our communities. And we need to be prepared to be at the table. And I think that's literally very helpful. We need to be at the table with folk with whom we disagree, sharing fellowship, sharing meals together, inviting them to our houses, being hospitable, eating and drinking and speaking with those with whom we might still fundamentally disagree. We need to be at the table. Now, all that is good, surely. And if that's what we mean by pluralism, then we can be endorsing it. But what we cannot accept is the relativism of popular sort of notion of pluralism and of what we sometimes call this postmodern mindset that insists that every version of reality is as valid as the next one. No one version can claim to be true because, in fact, actually, they would say we're not even sure if there's an elephant there at all. You see, the basic fallacy of the elephant fable with which I began is this. If you ask the popular pluralist, the relativist, the postmodern sort of attitude to truth, where would you be in the story, what would they have to say? Well, they'd have to just choose two options, wouldn't they? Are you like one of the blind men, or are you like the Raja, the king? Now, if the storyteller is like one of the six who can't see, if he's one of the blind men groping around, well, then how does he know everyone else is blind and has only a portion of the truth? On the other hand, if he fancies himself in the position of the king, well, equally we can ask, how is it that he alone escapes the illusion that blinds the rest of us? How has he, the pluralist, how has he attained to that superior position? What superior insight does he have that's been denied to the rest of us? Isn't that extremely arrogant? Isn't that an amazing claim to make? That he alone can see the whole picture? That he alone is the seeing one? And so you see, equally to say that there's no absolute truth is in itself, of course, an absolute truth statement. If everyone truly is blind, then no one can know if he or anyone else is mistaken. And surely that includes the popular pluralist as well, and the postmodern skeptic. Only someone who knows the whole truth can identify others who are only in possession of part of it. And in our story, in the fable, of course, only the king can do that. No one else can. We're all in the dark. We're all blind. And maybe as Christians, we would want to use that fable, which originates from India, in a sort of ironic way and turn it on itself. Maybe we want to say, maybe the parable of the six blind men, the elephant and the king, to a great degree, is an accurate picture of reality. It's just been misapplied. We are like blind men, fumbling around in the world, searching for answers to life's deepest questions. From time to time, we seem to stumble upon some things that are true, but we're often confused, we're mistaken, we don't really know, just as the blind men were. But how do we know this? Because the king has spoken. He is above, instructing us, advising us, correcting our error, pointing us to truth. The king has spoken. The central claim of the Christian faith is that the king has revealed himself, not from the balcony, of course, but he has come down from heaven in a specific historical and geographical context, and this revelation can be investigated and debated and dialogued about because it centers around the historical person of Jesus of Nazareth, who lived on this earth some 2,000 years ago. That's the significance of the New Testament records of the life of Jesus and the testimony of those who began to follow him. We read about them in the Gospels and in the Acts. Here were men and women whose lives and worldview had been completely changed. Why? Because they'd met Jesus. In fact, so revolutionary was the effect Jesus had on them that they were now prepared to face all sorts of threats and beatings and imprisonment and even death, rather than deny the truth that they had come to believe about him. We read about it in the Gospels and the Acts, as I say, very early on in the life of those first Christians, not long after Jesus had gone back into heaven to the presence of the Father. They were faced with threats from religious establishment to stop preaching, stop speaking about Jesus. There's one account in Acts chapter 4 about Peter and John who'd healed a blind man, and they'd stirred up the people, and people were running to know who had this power. Why could they heal this blind man? And so the religious authorities called them in and told them, you must stop speaking about Jesus of Nazareth. They beat them. They put him in prison overnight. And what was Peter and John's response? In Acts chapter 4 and verse 12, we read these stunning words. Salvation is found in no one else. For there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Now, they made that bold, exclusive claim, of course, because, as they tell us, they'd been first-hand witnesses of God's supernatural power in and through this man, Jesus of Nazareth. It is by the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom you crucified, they said boldly to those leaders, but whom God raised from the dead. It's by his name, by his power, that this man stands before you healed. These first disciples, they were prepared to stake their all on this newfound faith in Jesus, because he was utterly unique. And they'd come to see this. How was Jesus unique? Well, very briefly, in three ways. First of all, in his creed. No one before and no one ever since has taught such sublime truths, given such high moral guidelines, commanded such loving response as Jesus Christ. Even the secular world will agree with that. No other religious leader. Love your enemies, he said. Pray for those who hate you. Do to others what you'd like them to do to you. Accept one another. Forgive each other. Not just once, but again and again and again, Jesus said. Now, such teaching has never been surpassed in human history. He's unique in his creed. Then he's unique in his character as well. You see, it's all very well saying, isn't it, love your enemies, but it's another thing to pray, Father, forgive them when those enemies are driving metal nails through your hands and feet and crucifying you. But that's what this Jesus did. His was an utterly consistent life. Even his enemies couldn't find any moral blemish in him to put him to death. And his friends, people who knew him really well, they agreed. One of them said he committed no sin and there was no deceit in his mouth. Unique in his character. And finally, there's the enigma of his cross. Unique. Unlike any other human being who has lived on this earth, Jesus Christ approached his death, his cross, with a sense of the purposes of all eternity being fulfilled through his suffering. If I am lifted up, he said, I will draw all men unto me. No man takes my life from me, he said. I have power to lay it down and I have power to take it up again. I did not come to be served, but to serve, he said, and to give my life a ransom for many. What was he talking about? He was talking about the freedom, the forgiveness, the liberation that he was going to accomplish for all the world. He was talking about that way of rescue and forgiveness of sins, which he was going to achieve through the sacrifice of his life for all the world. Now, no other religious leader has ever spoken like that, has ever made such unique claims about his life and about his death. And no other religious leader has demonstrated his authority to accomplish what he said he would do, as Jesus has. So that's what the first Christians believed and announced unapologetically in the multicultural and pluralistic world of the first century. And so how should we engage with our 21st pluralistic century? Well, I think in two ways. First, with a concern. With a concern to respect others. We need to learn from the past. We need to engage with a concern to accord others a hearing. To be gentle. A concern to be humble as we approach people. To respect them for who they are. People actually made in the image of God. People who are searching for the truth themselves. We need to engage with that sort of concern and respect and humility. But finally, we need to engage with a conviction. A deep held conviction. To present the gloriously unique Savior of mankind that Jesus Christ truly is. In all our dialogue, in our concern and our respect, we don't give up on those basic commitments of who Jesus is, of what he has done, and what he's going to do still for this world.